Thanks, Peter, for the nice introduction and especially for the invitation to come here to Santa Barbara at a beautiful time of the year. I think I have to warn you first, because I'm not a physicist. I'm really plant physiologist and plant biologist of my training. And it happened somehow to me that during the last years, I worked together with physicists before my time working in this bubble, working on single leaves. And I want to talk a little bit especially about leaves, these green things we see around all the time. Oh. It is. It was built, I think, 85 by a Texanian millionaire. And by the way, interrupt me anytime, especially if I disappear in some kind of plant physiology, biological terms you don't understand or for any questions. Just raise questions, raise your hands.
He's not a Texas millionaire, he's a Texas billionaire. You know, billionaire is one that don't even get mentioned.
Okay, by at best, Texas billionaire in the mid-80s. And it was a mixture between global climate change was just becoming a topic. People started to go into the space, and they wanted to set up an environment where all the energy and the substances and all the circles are closed. And they wanted to test if humans enclosed in this totally enclosed environment can survive, can produce their own food, can breathe the oxygen which is produced by the plants. And this was an experiment. I think the first mission started 89, which totally failed. Then they tried a second one, which failed too. Then it was abandoned for a couple of years. And then finally, Columbia University took it over with the idea of maybe doing global climate change research, experimental global climate research in this enclosed, controllable ecosystems inside. And this obviously, I don't know if it's really failed. We had a lot of publications. I think research picked up quite fine, but it's extremely expensive to especially heat or cool this greenhouse in the middle of the desert. So Columbia, mostly of financial reasons, pulled out. And if somebody wants to spend $2 million each year to keep it alive, I think it's for sale at the moment. I'm not sure. I think we... Sunlight comes in, exactly, energy comes in. So we have a big power plant, so it means cooling and heating comes in, but it's totally air sealed, yeah, including the soil compartment. So no oxygen, water, CO2 comes in, the water budget is closed and controllable. For 18 months in a row, yeah.
The
bionauts.
Well, they got
oxygen. They ran out of oxygen.
Right, but the plants got, there were various, infections of organisms like that. Yeah.
Right.
And the other thing was the concrete was a problem, right?
Exactly. Right. Yeah, they made some mistakes where you, in the meantime, I think it's kind of foolish, but it was mid-80s, and they thought they want to have an ecosystem which is really sustainable for a long time period. So they put in really nutrient-rich soils with a lot of microbial organisms, thinking about, well, we need something to support life on a long period, totally ignoring that microbials in the soil breathe like hell. So the CO2 concentration went up, the oxygen got down, was mainly fixed by the soil. And then they could not produce enough food for them, and they could not close this. So they could not bring all the plant biomass back on the fields because they were totally over-nutritioned already. And then they had cockroaches living in the... And yeah, what do you do with a lot of rotten plant material in a closed environment? That's heaven for cockroaches. You get a lot of cockroaches. But before I came to this place, I worked in Darmstadt University. And there, we worked with spatial temporal variations of metabolism in a plant plant rhythm. And back to the leaves. Biologists normally regard leaves as the organs of photosynthesis. And I think even though they come in various shapes and different forms, normally leaves in plant physiology, plant biology, are regarded as one physiological unit, which are produced by plants in terms for photosynthesis. And I thought I'd give you maybe a little bit of backup for what biology students learn in the first year. So the standard textbooks normally looks on the vertical stratification of leaves, which are sealed on the top layer and a low layer with a rather thick so-called epidermis. And inside, there's a various difficult amount, various cells, which are mainly focused on facilitating this process of photosynthesis. Gas exchange, or exchange of carbon dioxide inside the leaf and oxygen outside of the leaf and water, is normally mediated by stomates, small pores which actively can be opened and closed by the plants to either restrict CO2 uptake and water loss or to facilitate this water loss. And another close-up of the stomates. And what... Wrong. One cell, this is one cell, should have approximately the diameter, I think, of 100 micrometer. Uh-huh, exactly. And there is a various amount, force can be drawn back inside the plant to reduce transpiration. And this is a big topic in plant physiology research because on the one hand, the plants want to take up CO2 because this is the substrate of photosynthesis. On the other hand, the water-filled cells inside the leaves and the high humidity inside the leaves result in a high water loss, especially at dry habitats. And I will come to this point later, so plants normally use this pores to balance between the thing, not to starve and not to desiccate. And these are the organs to control this. The guard cell? Right. The idea is that you have, where do we see it best? Mm-hmm. Yes. We have specialized guard cells, which normally are surrounded by, maybe it's better seen at this one. Not really. OK. This is not too bad. You have, normally you don't have green material, no green chloroplasts in the epidermis, neither in the low one nor in the up one. But then you have green chloroplasts capable of doing photosynthesis inside the whole so-called stomata. And those then, the stomata are then surrounded by the next cell, which is called guard cell. If the plant wants to perform photosynthesis, light is sensed by the stomata cells itself because they are photosynthetically active or capable. In combination with the guard cells, they manage to shuffle potassium, I think it's potassium, from the one cell to the other cell, increasing the turgor inside the stomata cells, and like a balloon which you blow up, the stomata open. And this is this interaction between the guard cells and the stomata cells, which normally controls the opening, the width of the opening. And the funny thing, The nice thing is that this little machinery of two cells normally works totally independent from other cells. So plant physiologists knew for a long time that some areas of the leaves or the stomates of some area of the leaves can be wide open while neighboring areas may be still totally closed. And this is a process which is called, or a phenomenon which is normally described as stomatal patchiness. Means some leaves have different stomatal openings on some at specific areas of the leaves, while others are still closed. This patchiness normally was assumed in leaves, and guard cells are assumed to operate independently, as plants, as everybody knows, lack totally any nervous system. And in general, we assume that there's no communication among the different leaves. And about, I would say, 6 years, 7 years ago, these were the only spatial phenomenon which were described, which were understood, and which were accepted in plant physiology.
So what do we see
on this picture? On this picture, we see GSI, which is the conductance for water vapor pressure on different areas.
It's not a
false color. It's false color. No, sorry. I should really take some more time. No, this is a false color for the conductance of water, means which is a measurement of the opening width of the stomates. What I would more like to talk about is, do we have additional spatial phenomenon on single leaves independent of this stomatal regulation, which seems to be obvious, but in some respects not highly interesting, as these are just the local distribution of single elements which seem not to communicate with each other. And by doing this, I would like to look on photosynthesis a little bit more, and really on the degree of photosynthesis. Little bit of theory. You are totally welcome to forget this again. If you want to measure photosynthesis, and this is an algae suspension, light absorbed by chlorophyll A normally results in excitation of the electrons in the chlorophyll A. And as a normal biophysical process, these excited electrons are then used in the light reaction of photosynthesis, are slowed down and controlled by a cascade of different pigments and enzymes to be used finally photosynthetically and can be finally used for the fixation of carbon dioxide. Some of these excited electrons are transverted back to the ground state and emit, I think this is pretty common for pigments, and emit a fluorescent signal, which for the chlorophyll results in this in a red fluorescence, in a far red fluorescence. By a nice or little trick where we excite the fluorescence where we excite the chlorophyll for a short time period by a saturating light pulse, we can block totally the light reaction of photosynthesis, resulting in a maximum fluorescence. And out of this ratio of maximum fluorescence and ground fluorescence, we pretty much can estimate how much light intensity or how much electrons of absorbed photons are really shuffled into photosynthesis. This is a measure developed about 10 years ago. The nice thing is that this is a measure which is totally non-destructive, can be done over a long time period. And over the last years, this method only also became applicable with using imaging techniques. So we can image, and this is a section of one leaf. There's the stem. This is the midrib. The tip is somewhere over there. And we can measure the fluorescent signal of chlorophyll A selectively at low light intensities, and then superimpose the whole thing, the whole leaf, with a saturating light pulse, having maximum fluorescence by blocked photosynthetic apparatus, having a maximum fluorescent signal. And then with really simple relations, we can estimate what is really the efficiency, the light use efficiency of photosystem 2. Means how much percentage of the absorbed photons can be really used photosynthetically, which is kind of a nice, powerful tool for ecophysiologists who really would like to know, well, how efficient is a photosynthetic apparatus? And not to confuse you in the next thing and to make the whole thing a little bit more colorful, most of the pictures I will show in the future are color-coded and color-coded in terms of to describe the photosynthetic efficiency with normally low values at blue over green up to red. Methodological background.
Yeah. What is meant by an efficiency of one?
Okay. In principle, the maximum efficiency photosynthesis can operate at a totally healthy higher plant is at 0.83. Means 83% of the absorbed photons can be used photosynthetically. This then is downregulated at higher light intensities to values of about 0.2. In order to measure this quantitative parameters, specific properties of the measuring techniques have to be achieved, which normally cannot be achieved using imaging techniques. But just a technical thing, all the CCD cameras and all the imaging devices we have at the moment are not sensitive enough to distinguish between specific parameters of the fluorescent signal. The reason is that I give the efficiency of photosynthesis in relative values, meaning I will show time series which are captured under the same constant conditions, and the maximum value which is obtained is set to 1. Which corresponds to a numerical value of about 0.7.
So it's not what you defined in the previous slide.
No.
You've now redefined it so
exactly.
That it's just an arbitrary scale.
Right.
Which you defined to be between 0.8, 7, and 1.
Exactly. And the arbitrary scale is in some respects a little bit linear, as the percentage difference at this arbitrary scale really represents percent differences in the original scale. But I don't know what the linear offset is. So it's most likely 0.7, which would be then 0.6. But the 0.7 is kind of wobbly and cannot be determined numerically. Just if you want to do some experiments like this, there in the meantime, there are some instruments on the market which measure the chlorophyll fluorescence on an imaging basis. There's one Czech system, one German system, and I think Leica, which is a big American producer, works on this now too. Using these systems, people started really, really simple, and they looked on, for example, on the effect of herbivore feeding on leaves. This again is the midrib. The leaf tip is somewhere over there. And this is the feeding pattern of some herbivores. And you can clearly see how this destruction of the leaf propagates in the still healthy leaf blade, reducing the efficiency of photosynthesis. Or another thing which is kind of an emerging thing is for product screening at the moment, where this is a lime which developed, I think it's hard to see in this light, but which developed the first visible signs 7 days, at day 7 of this experiment. And the development of this mold, it's a mold which develops here, can be detected using chlorophyll fluorescence already about 5 days before really visible signs get obvious. People out of the food industry want this a lot because they try to sell still the slimes, which look quite fine, but they know that they will get rotten within 2 or 3 days, and they want to have this done at years rather than not in the supermarket. So this is a big, big market at the moment where chlorophyll fluorescence comes into plant physiology, or imaging of chlorophyll fluorescence comes into plant physiology and application in the moment. What we did, back to the leaves, which we monitored, we wanted to know how is the photosynthetic efficiency of leaves on the leaf blade, on the spatial distribution of leaf blade, really distributed. And again, starting with a simple thing, I will give you just a run through a little bit the experience of the last 7, 8 years, looking on the leaf blade of a leaf which is variegated. This is has an Butylum strictum, which is a plant virus infection, which obviously renders some of the areas really brightish yellow and not green, which the underlying reason is that this virus restricts the building or the constitution of the photosynthetic apparatus. So these areas appear to be yellow rather than green. And of course, looking on the fluorescence images, we can see, without going into the details here, we can see that there's a huge spatial variation of the photosynthetic efficiency of these leaves. Surprisingly, the virus-infected areas are more efficient than the green areas, which was a little bit surprising at the beginning, but then we found out that this high efficiency results in a non-protection against excessive light, so these yellow areas will suffer stress and will suffer destruction because of radicals earlier than the green areas. Another example where we now look, I don't have a big picture, it can be seen maybe here, where we look, these are small veins on the leaf, so the scale is approximately, I would say it's 1.5 centimeters across this image. And we looked on the wilting process or the drying process of these leaves, and it was obviously that the drying of those leaves also did not occur homogeneously distributed over the leaf plate, but there were areas of the leaf which were much more sensitive to wilting than others.
So these patches are the veins,
Exactly. These patches, right, I should mention it exactly. These patches are where the veins are, and this is definitely something where we still have this anatomical relationship to some areas which are closer, adjacent to the veins, dry later than those in the midvein. Because the water distribution comes through the veins. There's another example of Niels Baker from Nevada University, who looked on maize leaves. And if you consider maize, you have these parallel veins on the maize leaves which run in this direction. And he also found that a maize leaf obviously is not as homogeneously distributed. This again is the quantum efficiency of photosynthesis, as normally would assume if you look on this nicely green homogeneous leaf of a maize. And Niels Baker then went down, and I want to have this is maybe for the next time a little bit, and he went down the scale. This is one stomate we talked before, and the yellow or the white dots in there are the single chloroplasts in this stomate. And surprisingly, the chloroplasts are differently active regarding if the stomate is open, means the chloroplasts are really actively working, or if the stomate is closed. And he's working at the moment at the spatial distribution of this chloroplast within single cells, which seem to change to according to the activation status. So in the small scale, within a cell, the organs or the structures of photosynthesis, means chloroplasts, seem to be heterogeneously distributed. And also on the larger scale, looking in a whole plant, this is an Arabidopsis mutant. Arabidopsis is a little bit this toy plant of plant physiologists because it's totally sequenced. We have some mutants in the meantime where we can knock out, overexpress some probabilities, and the plants stay alive and really develop normally. So we can look on the induction of specific genes and how this induction of genes results in the induction and manifestation of the photosynthesis in the origin of different organs.
So there seems to be some regulation here because this is not really randomly.
Right. This is something which Neil Baker worked at the moment, Chang-Sang Li in Berkeley has some mutants which express the protection mechanism of photosynthetic apparatus differently. And they see how this depends on the developmental status of the leaves. And as you see, there's some time lag when leaves start to develop their protection mechanisms of photosynthesis against high light. But that's, I admit, this is not where I would like to talk in the future. I would like to come back to the very beginning, to the Biosphere 2 Center. And what I did during the last week, I concentrated a little bit on some plants, keeping all the things which I told you now just as an introduction in mind. I concentrated a little bit on cacti or succulents, which have a specific kind of photosynthetic mechanism which is called crassulacean acid metabolism, or the abbreviation much easier, CAM, CAM photosynthesis. And almost all the succulents, almost all the plants of dry habitats have this specific kind of photosynthetic mechanism. The idea behind this, that I said at the beginning, that plants always have the problem of starving because they don't get enough CO2 for photosynthesis, and losing too much water because they have to store open their stomates and uninvitably lose a lot of water while having the stomates open. CAM plants, or crassulacean acid metabolism plants, invented this byway or a little bit modification of photosynthesis. They take up CO2 during the night while the stomates are open. This CO2 then is fixed actively, and that's an active biochemical process, by an enzyme, and they form malate, which is an organic acid. This malate actively is transported into the central cell vacuole. In plants, you normally have a really big central vacuole, which is normally filled up with all the material which plants want to get rid of and cannot execute into the environment as animals do. So it's kind of a big compartment, which is a storage compartment. This compartment is filled up to a pH value of 2 with this organic acid. During the day, then, this malate, again, is remobilized. Out of the vacuole, the carbon dioxide can be decarboxylated from the malate and then used photosynthetically using the sunlight. The big advantage during the day is that the plant can keep the stomates closed while using the carbon dioxide. And even though if the whole fixing, storing, and remobilization is an energy-demanding process, in dry habitats, it's kind of an advantage to reduce the water loss significantly and performing CAM photosynthesis then rather than normal photosynthesis.
For normal photosynthesis, we have the things open and this stuff that happens at night and they sort of mix together.
Exactly. Normal photosynthesis, you can take out the whole thing, just carbon dioxide diffuses inside the leaf and is directly fixed photosynthetically. Right. Okay. So it's a timely disjunction between CO2 uptake from the environment and CO2 usage of the photosynthesis later on. The surprising thing is these are not specific new enzymes. These are really ubiquitous enzymes which you can find in all the plants. Which is really new for CAM plants is this high expression of a malate transporter inside the vacuole, which in some weird thing is switched on during the night and switched off during the day. So this shuffling of malate inside the vacuole and the remobilization later on is the peculiarity of CAM photosynthesis. But it's nothing really new invented, and surprisingly, about 10 to 15% of all the plants on the earth really do this or have the capacity to do this in some extent if they are exposed to dry habitats. That's also a little bit of thing. I do a little bit of CAM photosynthesis to reduce my water loss a little bit. One plant I would like to talk a little bit is called Kalanchoe dichromontiana. Terrible word. The nice thing about this plant is that this plant does CAM photosynthesis all the time, regardless of the environmental conditions. And what we can do is we take one leaf of this plant, enclose it in a plexiglass cuvette, an airtight plexiglass cuvette, which is totally continuously flushed with air. All the conditions inside this plexiglass cuvette are controlled, means we have constant humidity, constant temperature, constant light intensity. And then using or measuring the gas inflow and outflow of this cuvette, we easily can record the CO2 uptake rate, and JCO2 is a measure of the CO2 uptake rate of the plant. Here shown over 24 hours, and the same what I tried to explain before, the plant takes up 0 hours is the beginning of the night. The plant takes up CO2 during the night until the vacuole is totally filled, which reduces the CO2 uptake a little bit. And then with the on shift or the onset of light, there's a small transition phase, but basically there's no CO2 uptake from the outside by the plant, but the malate from the vacuole is remobilized, used photosynthetically, is fixed to produce sugars, and then only in the late afternoon, when the malate store may be exhausted, there's a little bit of CO2 taken up from the atmosphere again.
Does the plant have a clock, or is there light shining on?
At the moment, there's light shining on there. But I think that's exactly... That's dark. That's night, 12 hours darkness. Exactly. There, in this experiment, it's just... Exactly. Totally. But I think this is exactly the... Yeah, thank you. Thanks for this. And additionally to having these results at changing day-night conditions, this is also an endogenous clock, one of the maybe best investigated in plant physiology. Means if we... This, again, is the last night. And then if I leave on the light, and there, I promise, all the conditions are extremely well controlled, temperature up to 0.1 degrees centigrade, humidity and light intensity. And if we keep the plant in this cellular compartment somewhere in the basement of Darmstadt University, this rhythm of CO2 uptake, storage of the CO2 in the vacuole, the CO2 release from the vacuole, closure of the stomates, and then again, filling of this cycle continues. Okay, black
no,
is
next.
Black is darkness.
Right.
Normal day. This is would be normally night would be, but we keep it in continuous
so
light condition.
Light.
This is normal light.
No change in light. It's just
exactly.
Is gray.
Right. Okay.
Don't
good.
Yeah.
Exactly. The
And then followed this for a long time.
Yes, we followed it up to 21 days, where it continues running. The rhythm runs with about 21 to 22 hours. So it's not a rhythm which is some kind of hiddenly entrained.
So
the rhythm runs 21 days,
days,
and it has a period of 21 to 22 hours.
It readjusts the periodicity.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. The endogenous rhythm is 21 or 22 hours.
So don't you force it at a different time, not 24 hours, but 26, 28?
Uh-huh.
Will it follow?
Yes, it follows in a window, and then below thresholds and above thresholds, we have a free-running rhythm again. And at the borderlines, we have some really interesting modification of the superimposed and the endogenous rhythm. I can give you some reprints where we just exactly where we entrained the rhythm. And we did not use light intensity, but we used temperature changes, which are much closer to where we know better what happens to the physiology. And there we could even reconstruct, I don't want to talk about this, but I can give you some reprints where we could experimentally show a period doubling window in this entrained window. But it basically does everything which you would expect an endogenous rhythm or endogenous clock does. It can be entrained. It's very well temperature compensated. And it's a little bit shifted, fortunately, a little bit shifted from the 24-hour rhythm. So we really can be sure that we don't have any hidden entrainment from any small signal from the outside. If I plot the period of the rhythm versus the temperature, the temperature where I keep the leaf. I can repeat the whole experiment at 21 degrees centigrade, 22, 23 degrees centigrade. The period pretty much, and it's about, let's say, 18 to 27 degrees centigrade. It's.
You don't want 21 centigrade.
No, I don't want 21 centigrade. I want 21 hours. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This is temperature
no, on,
in.
On the period. What's the scale of
it? Okay, how do I write a period?
Where's an hour?
This is about 22 hours and 20 hours.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. If it's not temperature compensated biological system, you would expect that temperature increase of about 10 degrees centigrade would double biochemical processes, which would result in a much steeper.
No. It should just overflow. What do you know?
Mm-hmm.
The higher the temperature, the faster I go in any direction.
Right.
So it's just this way.
Yes.
It depends on where you think.
We don't know other ways. Could you draw what you call it by the mix?
I think I should be a little bit more. I think I should be a little bit more precise now. So, if we increase the temperature by 10 degrees centigrade, I would assume that every single biochemical reaction doubles in speed. I don't know. I cannot. I cannot really assume that the rhythm runs with a double period, because I only know, or have the period, or have the period. Because let me go to the next transparency, just to show that with below specific thresholds means 18 degrees at this, at, for example, and 27 degrees at this example. Or not example, that's pretty a stable threshold. I don't have any rhythm at all anymore. Means these oscillations sudden. There. If I repeat the same experiment as before, I adapt the plants to normal day-night cycles for at least 3 days, so it has the same pre-treatment. And then, if I transfer the plant without moving it or doing anything else to continuous light, same light intensity as above there. The only thing which is changed is that I don't do the experiment at 21 degree, but at 28 degrees centigrade.
And the prior experiment was done, I mean, 28 degrees.
Yes.
It, time
right. No, hang on. At this experiment, we played around with this. It was always 18 degrees during the night. No, 15 degrees during the night, 21 degrees during the day, pre-treatment. And from this time period on, I went to 21 degrees and 28 degrees. Different pre-treatment. Almost. This maximum. Yeah. This maximum is longer. So, or this half width is longer than the following one. So the shift in the period manifests after about 24 hours. The first period is a little bit different, and if you look on some of the biochemical pools, the first period has different properties for the first 24 hours in continuous light. And this seems to have something to do because until latest there, the plant has no idea that I will treat it in continuous light. And then it may be a really long day. And then it falls in the endogenous realm.
During the training period,
This one?
Yeah.
Yes. This is, I didn't forget your question. The weird second spike was also shown at the normal day-night cycle. It always appears if I suddenly switch on the light from the dark period. And this is repeatedly shown in lab experiments, will not take place in the real nature because their sunrise occurs rather smoothly and gradually. And this is a transition phase where, on the one hand, suddenly carbon dioxide is remobilized out of the vacuole, but the stomates are not closed yet. And this is exactly the transition. Yeah. Exactly, that's the closure time of the stomate, which takes a while, up to half an hour, an hour. That's exactly this. To your question, with the increase of the rhythm, if I only have a biochemical network, I only have biochemical reactions controlling the rhythm, I would assume different color, that I would have about, let's say, 20, 30 degrees is somewhere up there. I would assume a dependency like this, approximately. I will come to this later. Main regulatory processes for the rhythm most likely take place on the transport via the tonoplast membrane. And this is not a first or second order, not a second order biochemical reaction, because it's a shuffle over a transporter, over a membrane, which I think can explain in combination with some gene regulatory properties, where genes are switched on and switched off, which control competing reactions, means the carboxylation and the decarboxylation in a different way, that I can have a temperature compensation in this time window where the rhythm exists. But Yes. We managed to experimentally, if you handle it really carefully, you can have this transition from oscillations to arrhythmic gas exchange pattern in 0.4 degrees centigrade. Yeah. But that's kind of tricky to handle. The rhythm dies out faster. It gets overlaid by more arrhythmic variations. Nevertheless, they are really, by giving it to more people to judge, is this still rhythm or not, you can draw a borderline, and this by fitting some Hill functions and some things, you really can extract a clear endogenous rhythm, while at the others you cannot, or also in the power spectrum though. Say again? Exactly, right, yes. So we have, that's a nice example, but normally we have an arrhythmic behavior at low temperature, rhythmic behavior at middle temperature, arrhythmic behavior at high temperature. If we increase the temperature even higher, this arrhythmic behavior at about 34, 35 degrees gets really much flattened out. But then we are already in the biochemical range where the plant biochemistry is not really happy anymore. So there we really destroy. And this means that the biochemistry, but really flat. We did this, and we gave temperature pulses, not light pulses, but temperature pulses at different periods of the rhythm, different phases. Thank you. Please correct me if I'm not really precise. I think that's the biologist. At different phases of the rhythm. And we could shift the the endogenous period at some phases. At other phases, we cannot shift the endogenous rhythm. So there seems to be kind of a gating mechanism. Additionally, at the borders between the entrainable period, a shiftable period, and a non-shiftable period, that's where we had this bifurcation, where we realized that we can shift if we apply rhythmic external temperature pulses. We can shift the period alternatively in two different magnitudes in a small window. A little bit more about this arrhythmicity. People in Darmstadt were kind of intrigued, and this was already about 10 years ago when they first observed this arrhythmicity. And this was maybe one of the achievements of Lütke, who was a plant physiologist, or is a plant physiologist, who worked together with his old friend, Frieder Beck at Darmstadt, who's a theoretical physicist. And I said, well, that's not random. There's something underlying there. And this was at the time where chaos theory was kind of getting popular in also in natural sciences. And so they tried to prove if there's any deterministic chaos underlined there. They tried to reconstruct the strange attractor. Nothing really worked out, and I will explain soon why it did not. Another thing they did was to produce a minimal model where atypical for plant physiologists or biologists who normally want to model all the single pools of a complex biochemical pathway, they really try to reduce the model to the main pools which are necessary to maintain an endogenous rhythm. And they could reduce the pools to the leaf internal CO2 concentration, the malate, the organic acid in the cytoplasm, the malate inside the vacuole, and the tonoplast, this transport mechanisms over this membrane, which controls these two pools. This is exactly for the oscillation. Looking on the phase diagram, and good. Extremely good point. There were two working groups. The one set where it was in Edinburgh and now settled over to Reno University. And they were microbiologists. And they found a handful of genes which oscillate with the endogenous rhythm of chem plants. This was the one group, and they claimed that the main key switch or the main key oscillator somewhere is in the genes and the regulatory properties of the genetics. Lütke, where I was from, was an old plant physiologist and biochemist. He more believed that switching between inlet properties of an active transporter and regulatory outlet properties of a channel, and switching between these two states is more the driving force of this endogenous rhythm. They didn't speak to each other, I think, for 4 or 5 years, and each time when they met each other, it was a big discussion. In the meantime, they realized that the genetic oscillations do not continue as long as the endogenous rhythm continues. Means the rhythm seemed to be oscillating without genetic properties, or without genetic oscillation. Nevertheless, this really nice, totally unnoisy oscillations I showed you at the beginning for the first 4 days, they get a little bit more noisy after a while. They seem to need a really genetic regulation. Exactly, right. So it seems like that's really the main key switch, if things like this exist at all in biological networks, is at the transporter properties over the tonoplast membrane. To have the whole network really working properly, additional genetic biochemical feedback seems to be necessary. this is the state of the art at the moment. I don't know if they come up to some other thing. Yeah, Arabidopsis doesn't do comfort synthesis, unfortunately. We have another plant, which is called Mesembryanthemum crystallinum, which is a small plant. I think it grows out at the beach here, at the sea. At Reno, they think that they will it sequence within the next year. So we may have the chance to have some mutants of a Mesembryanthemum crystallinum. It's a little bit, but CAM photosynthesis, unfortunately, is always something which is not really high in the focus of plant physiology research. So the funding for Arabidopsis is much higher. I thought about if I should go into this model from the mathematical side, and then I got totally scared of that. I got lost in things. So you're more than invited to get these papers. Bernd Blasius, who's now in Berlin at the group of Kunz and Pikowski, continues with this or set this up. So you're more than welcome to read through this thing or tell me some new things. What I normally understand was this phase diagram where they plotted. Yes. They overcame this at the first modeling attempt to have a two-state transporter at the tonoplast, which is controlled by the malate concentration inside the vacuole, meaning at a high malate concentration in the vacuole exceeding a specific threshold, this oscillators or this transporter switched from inflow to efflow. Really rough modeling attempt for the first thing. Then in the second, this is the regulatory process. In the second process, they had a gradually shift of the inward or the active inward transporter characteristics and the efflux characteristics, depending on the concentration of the malate inside the vacuole. And this was the feedback loop which controlled the mechanism. And it was not a real biochemical, and with this two-stage switch, they could produce this phase diagram. I understand them normally like this, that a phase diagram where you can start at one point, and if you run the model at different temperatures, these are relative temperatures where I was told they have nothing to do with real temperatures outside, that we have at low temperatures a fixed point where the model runs into, at high temperatures a second fixed point, and then a limit cycle at medium temperatures. And there's another fixed point demonstrated which is close to this limit cycle. The reason why I'm telling this, or why I like this phase diagram, plant physiology, is first of all, with this simple model consisting of three pools and four flux equations, they could kind of neatly reproduce, and there we can discuss if it's really a good reproduction or if the shape of the curve is just different, but they could reproduce the oscillations in medium temperature regimes and the sudden transfer to the arrhythmic or constant gas exchange pattern. Back. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So this would be the real limit cycle for continuous oscillations. And this would be a fixed point close to the limit cycle, but still as a fixed point, which was used to run this model. programs in the fixed point. Well, that's exactly the point. That's where I can say, that's kind of neat, but it does not really reproduce the experimental finding which we have, where we had a lot of non-stochastic noise. No, that's not non, I shouldn't call it noise. Non-stochastic arrhythmicity.
Overly.
It didn't have a stochastic pattern in the power spectrum. Thanks, I just exactly what I think that's exactly where I'd like to come. And then this was the okay, first was the experiment this time. Normally we had a long time where the model asked exactly the question, like, is this really stochastic or is this deterministic? Hey, what is this? This time it was first the experiment. Because we wanted to find out what is exactly the borderline or the threshold when the rhythm reappears out of the arrhythmic gas exchange pattern. And this is an experiment, again, the last night. Continuous light, I promise next time only white. Continuous light, and the red line is the leaf temperature. So I start as the old experiment at 28 degrees centigrade. 28 degrees centigrade, we have an arrhythmic gas exchange pattern. Then I decrease slowly in 0.5 degrees centigrade the temperature and expected the rhythm to reappear. This was the aim of this whole experiment. And nothing happened. Down until 21 degrees centigrade. No rhythm reappeared. The first idea was that I maybe have killed the plant, something went wrong. So I increased the temperature for only 3 hours to 28 degrees centigrade and decreased it again. And surprisingly, the rhythm reappeared immediately. And this was kind of an experiment nobody could make sense out because it did not really fit in the whole module idea. It was not expected at all. And ideas? Yes. That's kind of amazing. No biologist came to this idea. The physicists I worked together exactly always come up, wait longer. Maybe it builds up. Yes, we did it. We waited for almost 1.5 weeks at this low temperature. No rhythm reappeared. So it was nothing which reconstituted by itself. Yes, we shifted the period. No, didn't have any difference. We played with the length of this. No, we can. We did it at day 5. We did it later. We did it not at the at different phases of an assumed underlying rhythm, which is just not visible. Knowing there may be some gating effects, nothing changed. It always reappeared. What we also realized is if we make this slope steeper, the rhythm reappears. If we make it deeper, yeah. If we decrease the temperature more abruptly, then the rhythm reappears, which is because that's kind of a suddenly decrease. We increased it about up to 12 hours per each half degree centigrade, which makes this experiment really long, but still it remained in the arrhythmic state. This was the problem. This made the experiment already 14 days long. And this is the borderline. If you have a really, really healthy leaf of a healthy plant in the early spring, then this plant survives 3 hours in continuous light. I think we could reinitiate it. People may discuss about this. But this was definitely beyond the borderline where we can assume that all the leaves are still happy. What we did then was we took the whole model and just overlaid the thing a little bit with noise. And I think they overlaid the flux equation inside, no, outside, the flux equation outside of the vacuo with white noise, meaning not changing a lot the really pronounced fixed point. The other fixed point, which was over there, is not shown in this graph. Not changing the clear limit cycle, but changing the fixed point, which is close to the limit cycle, by having this fixed point of behavior of the model randomly being kicked back per limit cycle, fulfilling one oscillation again, and then falling in the limit cycle, staying for a while, and randomly being kicked out again. By doing this, not only for one cell, but assuming that on one leaf, different areas, different cells may behave independently, and we measure the gas exchange pattern over the whole leaf area during this time period, they pretty well could reproduce the experimental results shown before. This, again, is the experiment, adaptation, high temperature, reduction of temperature with the remaining arrhythmic gas exchange pattern. The temperature pulse, the rhythm reappears. And then I didn't show this before, but the whole process is reversible. So if I increase the temperature, rhythm dies out again. And by modeling this skeleton model, which is overlaid with a little bit of noise, and they are just averaged over 8 cells, which are not coupled with each other. Really a really naive, simple approach. They already could reproduce this experimental result rather nicely, kicking the whole model system in a fixed point for a short period of time with a high temperature treatment, and then starting all the oscillations on the limit cycle in phase again. Right. I think he cut this off. This is, oh yeah, he could not, Dantlasius could not run the model in the two conditions, mean darkness and light, in one run. So he normally started the model formulation at this time period. Exactly. This idea is just the hypothesis that different areas of the leaf are oscillating. That a single area of the leaf at low temperature starts to oscillate again, but as having independent areas on the leaf, I have shifted oscillations on different areas, which by measuring over the whole leaf area are detected as an arrhythmic gas exchange.
And the pulse then synchronizes these various oscillators.
Exactly. And the pulse synchronizes these various oscillators. This was the theory. And I think with this. This is the measurement of a single leaf. And this is the simulation, assuming that one leaf has different populations or areas on the oscillators on one leaf bit. Yes. That's a picture from the experimental setup. We have the little poor plant. The leaf is still attached. We take off the two leaves above this because this would cause shading. But the leaf stays attached to the plant. The plant does surprisingly good in this kind of some kind of elastic material with which the leaf is fed through. It's tightened up. And then next to this cuvette, or this plexiglass cuvette, there's a climate control device which continuously pumps air through and controls humidity and temperature inside this cuvette. And the whole setup is located in a walk-in growth chamber, which again is located 2 stories below the ground, Darmstadt University of Technology.
So the temperature changes only in the cuvette?
No, for the whole plant. also the light, there are different light sources above the whole experimental setup, which are synchronized with the light inside the cuvette. The tight control of 0.1 degrees centigrade I only can maintain inside the cuvette. The chamber has variations of about 0.5 degrees centigrade. So the whole plant is not as precisely controlled, but still it's one of the best growth chambers I've ever worked in. But inside the cuvette, there the conditions are really, really tight. Exactly. This would be then now the thing where we came to the point, well, we have to know what really happens on the leaf area in a spatial, as a spatial information or spatial measurement. And this where we set up, or I set up this fluorescence imaging system where all this whole introduction was about. We had the challenge that we still had to control the conditions in the leaf and wanted to monitor the photosynthetic efficiency of reasonably big leaves. They come up to this size. Most of the commercial apparatus work in a 1 to 2 centimeter scale. So we had to build this by ourselves with having 8 halogen lamps, which still can illuminate the photosynthetic apparatus with a saturating light pulse for 1 second. And then a digital camera, which specifically records the fluorescence signal. And I think this is still the only setup where we really can monitor the quantum efficiency of photosynthesis simultaneously with the gas exchange and still have the whole thing totally, totally controlled. I want to go a step back, or I should not, maybe, well, I should. Let's start again with a simple thing like normal day-night cycle. 12 hours night darkness, 12 hours day at 18 degrees centigrade, 25 degrees centigrade night, darkness again. And I only look at the dark, at the light cycle. This is the enlargement of before, this weird spike at the morning, then a close of the stomates, and the remobilization of carbon dioxide, and then a little bit of carbon dioxide uptake in the late afternoon. If I then monitor the quantum efficiency measured by chlorophyll fluorescence, and now only integrated over the whole leaf, and this was an experiment where I didn't expect anything. It was just the thing where I said, well, we should test if our new method really is capable to monitor this CAM photosynthesis. So I integrated over the whole leaf, and there was a transition phase at the late afternoon when the malate pools are exhausted, quantum efficiency goes down and then recovers again as soon as the stomates open. Physiologically, it makes totally sense. I have a substrate limitation in the late afternoon because I have a limitation of carbon dioxide. Surprisingly, looking on the images, the fluorescence images or the quantum efficiency images on different time periods, they are numbered from A till P, it was kind of surprising that quantum efficiency was not homogeneously distributed over the whole leaf. There was weird small-scale patches at the early morning. These are the first hour after the onset of the light. Then the leaf gets reasonably homogeneous during the midday. The midrib is maybe a little bit more active. And then in the afternoon, when the transition between exhausted malate pools occurs and stomates open up again, I think it's kind of visible in the side that there are wavefronts, first at the lower half of the leaf, so this is the midrib, lower half, which are initiated at the beginning, run over the leaf, and then a similar effect happens at the upper half, another wavefront of higher photosynthetic efficiency running over the leaf. I have 2 movies which show this, that it's really a rather dynamic process. So it's a time-lapse movie where 1 second in the movie corresponds to 1 hour in reality. And we have a resolution of 3 images per second. This is a homogeneous leaf, and then transition phase first at the bottom, and then up on the upper part. Wavefronts are initiated, run over the leaf. They don't have to start at the base of the leaf. They can be initiated at different areas of the leaf, like this part there, and within a time window of 1 or 2 hours, which exactly corresponds with this transition of the metabolism, with waves of higher photosynthetic efficiency run over the leaf. Was not really expected, resulting in a nice PhD thesis, because it was a plant physiologist, I think, assumed that this leaf, which especially is totally flat, doesn't show a lot of anatomic peculiarities, was totally assumed to act as a physiological unit. My colleagues in physics always tell me that if I present this to physicists, I should mention that wave fronts, which we sometimes happen to see that they meet each other, they do not superimpose, but they extinguish each other. This is one example where two wave fronts run on each other. This was a simple approach in the day-night cycle. So we expected some more during this endogenous rhythm, where really the endogenous clock of the plant is operating. Same experiment or similar experiment as before, an adaptation phase. And then we go into continuous light at 21 degrees centigrade. 21 degrees centigrade is the perfect temperature range for this endogenous rhythm. And again, first, the test if my chlorophyll fluorescence machine really monitors the physiology of the plant, and quantum efficiency oscillates totally in correlation with the gas exchange pattern. So another, we think that we really can monitor photosynthetic efficiency by using chlorophyll fluorescence. And then I want to divide this up a little bit. I would like to look first on this transition phases, where CO2 is taken up, and then again the transition where CO2 is remobilized out of the vacuole. Means the transition from maximum CO2 uptake to minimum CO2 uptake. This must be the transition where then the CO2 out of the vacuole is used. This is reflected in a really, really sharp transition in the chlorophyll fluorescence, so a sharp decline in the chlorophyll fluorescence within 1 or 2 hours. And by looking at these time windows from A, B, C, D, E, F, we have a reasonably homogeneous leaf before and after, and some small-scale patches occurring for this 40-minute time window in between. And these are, I described it as small cloud-like patches, which seem to occur at the same areas of the leaf at different periods, but at totally different areas of the leaf if I repeat this experiment with a new leaf. And they don't seem to have any correlation with any veins or any anatomical structure I found on the leaf. One second. Exactly. So it's a 14-bit digital camera which takes a fluorescence image. Then saturating light is switched on, which has about the intensity of sunlight for 1 second, blocking photosynthetic apparatus. And then at the end of this 1 second flash, the second image is taken. And that's it. So it's really a non-destructive method, and we didn't see any influence of this measurement to the rhythm. And looking on this phenomenon a little bit more close in detail, I just followed some of the spots, of single spots of the leaf. And it really appears that we have a phase shift where some areas, like the red one, shifts its metabolism earlier than a neighboring spot, which has a time lag of up to 1.5 to 2 hours for this transition between CO2 uptake and CO2 release out of the vacuole. I'm still not sure if this can be called real dephasing, as the whole rhythms really manage to fall together again after a while, and it seems to be fixed with some areas of the leaf. The smallest spot over there.
Yeah,
the red one. It's about an area of 8 by 8 cells, which we analyzed. And I will come to this point a little bit later. We think We did this some more biochemical analysis, and this is about, again, the size of an area. It's about, I think it's, it was 500 micrometer diameter, so half a millimeter of the cannula, where we punched out little leaf samples and analyzed those leaf samples. And this is the bad thing. It's a destructive method. So I had to be kind of lucky to and assume that this patch of the leaf behaves the same, and this patch of the leaf may behave the same. Kind of a difficult assumption. Nevertheless, we saw these two areas. The open symbols are from the bottom. The closed symbols are from the top. These two areas seem to behave totally homogeneously or totally in phase. And then there's a small time window where these two areas are totally disjunct from each other. And this is the malate, means the really the organic acid concentration inside the vacuole analyzing this thing. And this only window of decoupling, if you can want like this, happens exactly at this transition phase from maximum to minimum gas exchange pattern, which could support this idea that there are really some areas which shift their metabolism a little bit faster. But moreover, going a little bit further in the endogenous rhythm, I want to show some more pictures which are taken at least 2.5 days after the transfer to the endogenous, to the continuous light. And while we had a really homogeneous leaf at the beginning, there was a second kind of heterogeneity occurring at the leaf, which is shown as 6 examples here. In the enlargement, these areas look rather, I would say, kind of interesting. If you want to, you even can have concentric circles in there, or can assume that things like this occur. These are no destructions of the leaf. As soon as I transfer the leaf for 2 days in the normal day-night cycle, again, means switch off the light, switch it on, switch off, go to continuous light again, the leaf again appears totally homogeneous. So that's not a destruction of the photosynthetic apparatus. Following this process, and there are again 4 spots followed, 2 open, 2 closed spots shown in the lower graph. The closed, the open spots continues to oscillate, while this open spots, out of whatever reason, the closed spot, thank you, the closed spots, the filled out symbols, at one specific point, cease to oscillate and just fall in a kind of fixed point, which is a reversible fixed point. This was a wide field for some physicists, like Mark Hood, who is now at one of the new in German established junior professorships at Darmstadt University. And he looked on the fact, can he really quantify this heterogeneity, the spatial heterogeneity, which we see on the leaves? And he used methods from cellular automaton techniques, where he looked at the state difference between nearest neighbors, in my world, pixels of my image, or group pixels of my image. And there we come back to your question, how big those areas were. By measuring the mean state difference between neighbors, and by changing the binning, means the pixel size of my image, we could estimate which scale really the heterogeneity, the observed heterogeneity had. And by looking of about 0.5 millimeter, we had the highest change in heterogeneity, means the patches which show up most likely have the size of 0.5 millimeter. And this is then just the example that the heterogeneity really, really changes during this endogenous rhythm, with the small spikes of heterogeneity at the transition from maximum to minimum. These are the small cloud-like things which occur only for a small time period. And then after a while, when some areas of the leaves stop to oscillate, the heterogeneity of the whole leaf increases, but not in a static way, continues to oscillate with the endogenous rhythm. Right. You're totally right. I think that's exactly what I, this is just, I think I said this all. As I said at the beginning, we would expect phase-shifted oscillators at experiments like this. So where we start, because this was the whole starting point, we want to start at high temperature. There we can still assume that the whole leaf is in kind of a fixed point. But if we reduce the temperature to the rhythmic domain, I would expect phase-shifted single oscillators of the leaf. And I didn't find those experimentally. This was a nice hypothesis for the beginning, which definitely led us to some spatial phenomenon where we have some physiological explanation in the meantime, where we still have the intriguing thing, how do really ordered wave fronts like we observe, how can they be manifested? But we never found really single oscillators in the arrhythmic states which are totally phase shifted and independent of the leaf. Which
that is what you had in the model.
This is what we had in the model, right. So the model which with the phase shifted oscillators, which was published somewhere in the proceedings of the Royal Society. We had to publish in the next thing. Well, we didn't find it. It was a nice idea, but experimentally not in the arrhythmic state. We can continue looking for these a little bit. I personally doubt it. The changes which may occur are really difficult to detect as they occur in a small scale. As you saw, the scaling of the color bars is really, really small. So the differences are small, hard to detect. It's still, in my point of view, it looks more that the whole leaf is stopped at a kind of a fixed point, even though I have some spatial heterogeneity sometimes occurring. I could not relate this to any properties inside the rhythm. And we could not find following single points, we could not find any consistent oscillation of single areas of the leaf. Unfortunately, would have been nice. But. Yes, that's what I would have liked to do. Then I settled over to this bubble in the desert. And people continued this in Darmstadt. The idea was to go in with a small manipulating device where you can apply, for example, high temperatures or low temperature, and start single areas of the leaf, presumably start the rhythm in there and see if this propagates in the leaf. This experiment was never done. Maybe it will never be done. We tried to, what we did is we did the other way around. We stopped using specific inhibitors of the rhythm and injecting them at the area of a leaf. And then we once had, from here, I don't have the graph, the picture of this, we had the chance that a wavefront was running over this presumably inhibited area. And what happened is the wavefront just run around there. So there was nothing which you would expect that it spiraled up or something like this. It was just running over this. But there was no oscillation, at least, in this. This is pretty much, I think, the end of the story. I can still prove, or what we also did was, we still were intrigued if this has something to do really with the anatomy of the leaf, or if this has something to do with Kalanchiodichromantiana being an extremely weird plant. So we repeated the same experiment with another plant, Clusia minor, and which is a tropical epiphyte. And the nice thing of this plant is that the cum photosynthesis can be induced by slight water stress. So this plant does normal C3 photosynthesis. And by imposing a little bit of water stress, it switches over to cum photosynthesis. And the nice outcome of this was that this pattern formation, which I showed before from Kalanchiodichromantiana, those patterns are not visible here, they are. They only appear in Clusia minor if I switch it to cum photosynthesis, and we have a totally homogeneous distribution of photosynthesis at C3 photosynthesis. So it really has something to do with cum photosynthesis. And then we can now discuss a little bit, if you're still up to, what are the peculiarities of this CAM photosynthesis and what are the basis of this wavefronts which run over the rhythm. And one thing, and now that's only hypothesis and speculation because the experiments are not done yet. My hypothesis is that if we look on one transection of a leaf of Kalanichiodichromontiana, if you still can recall the first leaf I showed you at the very beginning, there were, even though it was only a schematic drawing, there were some cells which were surrounded by a lot of air-filled space. And this air-filled space is used and is important that CO2 from the outside can diffuse inside the cell and can reach the single cells where photosynthesis takes place. CAM plants, and especially Kalanichiodichromontiana, has totally different leaves. The boundary layers is one cell, one roundish cell, which is totally, that's a little bit clear, which is totally filled up with a central cell vacuole. And only these little darker areas pressed against the wall of the cells are the areas where the cytoplasm is and where the chloroplasts are located. So 96% of the whole cell volume is filled up with this vacuole, most likely as an adaptation to this need to store this huge amounts of malic acid in the vacuole. The whole rest, the intercellular space, the air-filled intercellular space is really reduced to a minimum, which is seen here. There's some air-filled space underneath the cestomate, an air-filled space. But if you go deeper in the tissue, there's almost no air-filled space. We detected it and we measured it, and it's about 4 to 6% of only air-filled space. And they are reasonably thick leaves. These are 100 micrometer. So the leaf is 2 to 3 millimeters thick. Has no anatomical structure between the top and the lower surface, and always this extremely boring ball-shaped cells. As a consequence, CO2 concentration or CO2 diffusion most likely in this cell is, or in this plant, is restricted to the wet cell walls or through the cells, where it's, of course, much slower than in the gas-filled space. A working group in Edinburgh, Kate Maxwell, measured the lateral diffusion of CO2 of the cell, and it's really strongly inhibited by the factor of 100 in comparison to normal C3 plants. And then we did some estimations and thought, well, how long would it, oh, sorry, forgot something. And then keeping in mind that during CAM photosynthesis, this remobilization of malate out of the vacuole and the decarboxylation of CO2 results in really high leaf internal CO2 concentrations. So in other CAM plants, concentrations up to 2% CO2 in comparison to the 0.03% CO2 in normal air were measured. Means I can have isolated spots of high CO2 in areas where carbon, where malate is remobilized out of the vacuole. And this high CO2 may well be isolated in these areas of the leaf, not diffusing quickly to the neighboring leaves. If it does, and this is then the speculation that people are working at the moment, it has to trigger some kind of the next regulation in the neighboring part to maintain this nice running wavefront I found, especially at the transition from high CO2, where CO2 is still remobilized of the vacuole, and low CO2, where it's not. This is the proposed mechanism which can be seen in parallel to some diffusion excitation media. The excitation part in CAM cells, the excitation of metabolism to higher CO2 concentrations, has to be proven experimentally. There are CO2 sensors known, which are patch clamped. As far as I know, we had this discussion before, as far as I know, they are not characterized biochemically so far. So what's really the basis of this? I have no idea. It's a little bit the working hypothesis. With this, I think maybe I should stop. I think so. Thank you for your attention.